Matt, do you hear us?
Steve, hurry. I have a bad feeling about this.
We have to know if he's still out there. Matt, are you there?
Steve? Paul, is that you?
Matt, finally, we found you. Are you safe?
For now, but I don't have much time.
Tell us where you are. We'll come get you.
Okay, I'm not very far. I'm over by the...
Say again, what? We didn't get that.
I said I'm over by the...
Man, we can't hear you. We need you to speak up.
I said I'm over by the...
He's gone.
No!
I knew this was a bad idea. Welcome to ScreenFit.
Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about John Krasinski's A Quiet Place. And this week we are so excited to have directors Paul Muzzin and Matthew Simone. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Thank you.
Paul was on before with Alien Covenant last year, so we welcome him back. And Matt, it's your first week, so welcome to the Freak Show, if you will.
I appreciate it.
You have no idea what you're getting into.
One of the most intense movies I've ever seen in my life, which I was not prepared for. I got home at the end of the day, and I was like, yeah, I guess I'll go watch this movie, bawling my face off.
Matt thought it was a documentary about wind.
Yeah, I thought it was about wind and people walking in the forest and that kind of thing.
The trailer came on, you only saw the opening clip. You just, okay, I see. I get the film now. They're just in
like a quiet place. That'll be a good thing after a stressful day of work.
Of course, A Quiet Place takes place in... Do they actually give us a destination? I don't. It's just sort of the rural Midwest, I think. And follows the Abbott family, played by John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, Evelyn and Lee Abbott, who have three children. And the world is under attack by creatures, mysterious creatures of alien or unknown origin.
They're demigorgons.
They are. We've just solved the mystery. There they are. Yeah. That do resemble the demigorgon, but are specifically attracted to sound. And as a result, there has been mass loss of lives at the hands of these beasts, and this is the story of one family as they try to survive. Guys, let's just get right to it. What'd you think of A Quiet Place?
Yeah, I love the film. Actually, I would say that I don't know if I would have looked at it with the depth that I was trying to if it weren't for Paul having chatted with me beforehand. He saw the movie ahead of time, and he said, and I knew that the film was about having to remain quiet without, you know, being eaten. And he had said, you know, what if this has to do with like oppression of voice? And I was like, wow, I don't think I would have thought of that if I hadn't started watching, or if you hadn't talked to me about this. So I tried to watch it with that kind of eye to see, you know, if there's some kind of metaphor or theme underneath what was going on. But as far as like a low budget, well, specifically like seemingly low budget movie, it's like what, $14-15 million it came in at for the film and such a small cast. It was like, it was such a tightly put together movie, and the pacing was fantastic. It gripped me from the very beginning. And I was glad it wasn't any longer, because I don't think my heart would have taken it.
With such a low budget and it's made so much money so quickly, they're already talking about a sequel, which breaks my heart. But I mean, you're right. They did a lot with very, very little in a number of ways. But Paul, what did you think?
Sorry, that was a little bit of quiet, because the movie took my breath away.
You could say it was A Quiet Place.
It was.
Could have just gone with that.
Sorry, you could cut that out. It doesn't really.
No, that's the type of stuff we leave in.
Let's put it this way. I was talking about this actually earlier, Stephen. How, you know, I go into the film. I got my little notebook. I'm prepared for it. To sort of think critically through it, as well as somehow try and stay engaged. And it was able to manage that. It was able to do that and manage those expectations that I had when I stepped out of the theater and I started thinking about it more so even than when I was sitting there, I felt that John Krasinski renewed my hope in independent cinema.
Hmm.
Because it reminded me of what I did as a kid back in high school making movies. Not that it was anything like this, but that feeling that I had of that nostalgia and that hope and that capacity to dream and envision things and then make it happen, that I left the theater really hopeful for those specific reasons. That being said, I would echo everything that Matthew talked about just a few minutes ago, where it was spot on. It was a tight script. The story was about a family essentially living in this situation. How do they try and live a sense of normalcy while surviving in this really oppressive new world that they've sort of had thrust upon them? And so, yeah, the story was just tight. And it's one of the first times in a long time that I wasn't bored in a film.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm really excited about it. I actually want to go back and see it again the second time. I think for myself, it would have been a more powerful moment being able to watch it in a packed theater. I saw it at a matinee, which was, I didn't get the full immersive experience with a big audience, but I loved it. It really spoke to me.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I saw it on a late show. And I live in Newmarket, so it's pretty rural up here in some ways. And it wasn't nearly there. I think there were only a few people in the theater, like a handful, 5-6 people. And it was missing something. It was missing something because I think the audience experience would have been pretty interesting for a film like this. This may be the first film. I'm already jumping ahead to my feelings on Screen It or Skip It. This may be the first film in 2018 that I feel like I can strongly recommend. You know, like I saw Ready Player One and I liked it and I thought, oh, it was a ton of fun and all this stuff. And I've recommended stuff usually with cautions. There hasn't been much this year so far, and it's only been the first 4 months, that I've really felt strongly about, like, this was great.
Yeah.
That often happens. But this film was so tight and it just clicks along. They drop you into the middle of it, and actually, by the end of the film, it's not even really resolved. There's a bit of a hope at the end, but it's not really resolved. So they sort of put you into this segment of time, which I loved. And, I mean, it reminded me a lot of Signs, and it's getting comparisons to Alien as well. But that's one of the things I really liked about it, is there's this... It's a type of horror film that almost isn't a horror film. Because it's not like going for the shock or the gore. It right. just wants to give you that feeling of constant dread
and terror.
And I mean, Alien is known for its gore, you know, chest bursting and all that stuff. But it really, that happens like 2/3 of the way through the film.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first 2/3 of the film is just terror. And every corner has a secret, and every shadow has a problem. You know, it's just every inch of the film, of the frame in Alien,
right,
is scary, and that's sort of how I felt with A Quiet Place. I really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, the visually everything's moving, and there's nothing, there's no static like image. There's always something moving and going, and it's neat because when I was reading about it a little bit, there's an interview with John Krasinski, and he talked about, like you said, like those influences of Alien and some of these other films, like Hitchcock and those.
Yeah.
The film that the horror films from the 50s and the 60s, the things that M. Night Shyamalan would have seen, and those would have influenced Signs. So that's, I think, for sure that resonates there. And a lot of it comes also in sort of maturity when he looks at Jaws. And watch Jaws, and it's like you don't see that creature fully until towards the end of the film. It leaves it up to your imagination, but that dread, that sense of dread and impending doom is just always there. Yeah, it's wonderful.
That was actually one knock against the film for me is that we saw a lot of the aliens or creatures or whatever you want to define them as. You saw a lot of them early.
Where, did I say they saw them late?
No, I didn't.
Should change that story.
Did you say you saw them late? I didn't think
I saw them late. Well, I mean the full body, maybe. Maybe. Yeah.
Well, I guess they slowly reveal it, but yeah, I mean you're seeing like you're not in the room with them until the very end, but I mean you do see them rather early. I'd say probably in the first third, which to me was just a little fast. Like I think it's just as scary to not see them in full, but I mean it didn't take away from the film at all. I just that would be if I were to give it a knock. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear that. One of the comments that I read and I thought about it going in was the music itself was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really moved you. I mean, visually, he's using visual storytelling. There's like 90 sentences uttered the entire film. Everything else is purely visual, but the emotion behind it is really being driven really hard by this sort of Hollywood blockbuster soundtrack. And it would be interesting to see what it would have looked like to pare that back a little bit and have it feel more silent the way that Silent Place is supposed to be and create those moments, those pauses, those beats. And you do get a little bit of that through Reagan's point of view as a girl who can't hear and is deaf. But yeah, John Krasinski basically said, he's like, I didn't want to throw people off and make them think this was some type of experimental film about no music or no sound at all, right? So I can understand that. But it would be a neat experience to see something like that.
I just realized that this movie was produced by Michael Bay. I didn't realize that. That's interesting because it doesn't come across as a Michael Bay movie at all.
Well,
I believe there is one moment where the camera does turn around and go around
it
the
does.
Protagonist like in a bay.
It's slow motion.
Yeah.
No explosions, though.
No, that is true.
Paul, I was thinking one of the – so because this set a lot of the tone for me watching the movie was your initial comment thinking about sort of more the, I guess, like the political, or necessarily, but like sort of the dimension where you talked about sort of like oppression of speech. Right. I thought that was a really interesting point, and that actually, it framed a lot of my watching. So I thought maybe you could comment on that because I thought that was pretty cool.
Steve and I talked about this just briefly before we connected, and he sort of made me think about it also in a little bit different way. But I mean, you're in this place where the creatures are attacking. Notice I didn't say aliens because they don't call them aliens in the show. But these creatures are attacking and oppressing the human population, right? And they are, as a means to survive, they reduce and remove their sonic impact on their environment. But the irony about that is that they're actually aiding and abetting in some ways the creatures of pressure on them, because it's only through the exploration of that sound spectrum that they're able to spoiler bite back, right?
Yep.
Because they're giant ears. Like, why didn't anyone put that through together till the end, right?
Yeah.
But so when I was watching it and I was thinking about this and I watched the trailer, I was like, oh, this is interesting because it's like, what does it say that you can't express yourself anymore, that you can't speak? What is that like in terms of, like, what does that say about, like, different people groups on our planet who maybe they live in the same type of similar type of dread and terror, or maybe they are being persecuted or facing that biggest bias in our society? Because when they do try and speak up, someone comes down on them and tries to silence them really quick. And so, I don't have an answer for that, but that's what I thought. That was one of the first things. I mean, there's a lot more that I can say about, like, the power and nature of communication. And, you know, like, and Steve mentioned it to me. We were talking, and I was like, okay, you have verbal, body language, sign language, you have print. There's sort of those light, fire, smoke signals that they're doing.
Yeah.
But, like, what happens if, like, the very essence, your voice, the very essence of who you are is being snuffed out?
Yeah, actually, and that's what I thought about a lot watching the film as someone who's, you know, a speaker and you know, does speaking in front of audiences and does a lot of communication through public presentation. When we talked, kind of leaving off, Steve, you were talking about the horror or the terror of that situation. Part of it for me was like the terror and horror of not being able to communicate with the people that you are leaning on for support in that very situation. Like, it's not even like, oh yeah, that threat is outside, but it's like, I can't even like comfort you necessarily. And yet they find ways to do that. And I think that was one of the brilliance of the acting, is that the characters were so expressive even in light of not being able to talk to one another. I mean, the scene with people were crying. I hear people crying when the scene when John Krasinski's character like gives the "I love you" and then is promptly gobbled up as he screams for the first time in the movie. You know, apart from the waterfall, and it was just such a powerful moment. And Paul, you referenced the fires. Oh, I love that scene. That was amazing. Yeah. Where they're up on top of the grain silo and he lights a fire and is like, oh, there's other people that are still alive. And they use light in a lot of ways as a symbol of hope in the film. And I thought in three cases in particular, one was the fires. Second was the lights outside the house just as a means of communication between danger or not. But then when she goes and disables the speaker on that rocket ship and she goes and relights it almost as like a type of
defiance.
Defiance, and also as a way of just remembrance of her brother, right, who died, and because that's at his like grave location or at his memorial location. And I thought, like, so hope is actually symbolized by the type of sense that the creatures don't have, which is light, right? And they're able to communicate with that with two other people, which I thought was super cool.
That's actually a really neat point.
Yeah, I never considered that. That's an interesting aspect. So you're associating hope with light. But that light is in and of itself a form of communication.
Yeah, and it's one that the creatures are blind to, right? They don't see it. So so in the midst of that terror, you know, the humans are able to communicate that hope to one another with light. So I thought it was really cool. And the fireworks, you know, which is kind of like there's a sound element to that, but there was a light component to it as well, because the one character she couldn't hear the fireworks, but she could see them. And that was her message to come back, right? To come back and help and find her brother, everything else.
One of the things I loved so much about the film is, I mean, you're talking about the different ways they communicate, and I thought that was so fascinating, you know, because like you said, you talked about it being hope. Those fires that were lit in their different beacons, it was a sign of comfort. There was some aspect of that that was drawing people together. And one of the things I thought was so fascinating about this film is that it shows that humans will always find a way to communicate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's part of who we are, is this just driven nature. Language is essential to who we are. Whether, you know, the film uses sign language, and I know that it was important for Krasinski to cast, I think Millicent Simmons, who is actually deaf. So that was essential for him. It wasn't just somebody who was doing a really good convincing job. It was actually somebody who, this is how she communicates. But the nature of communication, one of the things I thought is it really does drive community together. It can drive or separate community, is this nature of language. You talk about people from other cultures being unable to communicate with one another. The pastor side always kicks in on me because if you look at the scripture and look at the Bible, it actually opens and closes with language being split and brought back together. Because there's, you know, in Genesis, there's a story of Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel splits people because of their language. And then you see later on in the New Testament, the disciples speak one language that everyone understands. So there is this power associated with just communication and how necessary it is for us to function. It was a fascinating thing to watch because they just kept finding different ways to do it. Well, how did you guys think about language with the nature of love? Because this film, the most appealing part of this film is that it really focuses on the families. Family, because it's just the one family it really focuses on. But language seems to be an important aspect to that relationship as well. So I was wondering what you guys thought of that.
That's a good question. I hadn't thought of it in that type of capacity. Obviously, the film is kind of an exercise or a view of what it is to be a parent, what it is to be a cohesive family unit. I mean, one of the things that was made clear is that they're like a unit. Like, it's not one main character, it's the family unit as a whole is the main character,
right?
And each person is carrying either a different archetype at moments, you know, John Krasinski being, you know, he's the mentor, he's the trainer, he's the sacrificial lamb at the end, whatever it is that he's playing, each character, each act Doctor is bringing a different element of archetype to it. And then they also individually will tackle different components of the hero's journey. They don't all go through the same moments in the hero's journey, but as a collective whole, they do that. And I think it really talks about unity as being this thing that love unifies.
Hmm.
And I mean, the reality is they didn't learn sign because of this. They learned sign as a result of their daughter's disability. And that disability actually empowered them to be able to communicate, whereas other people throughout the world would not. And so I think there's definitely, I mean, I'm kind of straying from that topic of love, but I think that there's definitely something to be said about this theme of empowerment, whether it's, you know, training and rearing up a family, trying to protect them emotionally as well as physically, learning those new skills. I mean, I'm pretty sure what's his first name there again? Because he doesn't have Lee Abbott didn't know how to fix a cochlear. Is it cochlear implant? How do you pronounce that word? Co-ocular. No. Cochlear. I'll start that again. I'm pretty sure that Lee
Abbott. You need a hearing aid?
Fix a cochlear implant, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what it was. And yet he is empowered to do that to help his daughter in this really dangerous circumstance. She may not have needed it in the regular normal world, but they're in this really weird space now. And so I thought it was interesting just the idea of like how many times are we in that kind of self-control that we are that precise, that we are really focusing on every single sound that our body makes to survive. And being able to do that and find that courage, it's just absolutely incredible. That, again, that's a straight from the whole love component, because I didn't really think of that. I mean, other than the little moments of love throughout the film, I think that was one of the guiding principles they had, was every single scene, every single moment throughout this film needed to answer that question, what does it say about family? What does it say about love? And it's there throughout the whole thing.
You know who that world would be particularly terrible for? It would be people who snored. I was thinking about this. I was like, snoring would be the worst. Like, what if, you know, you just, that's it. You just die in your sleep and you never, because you can't help it, you know? Because you were talking, Paul, you mentioned all the sounds that your body makes. Well, snoring is one of them. And it's just, how would you stop that?
Kind of went the other way from the love aspect here. No, well, I'm just.
I would, as a brother, say, Matt, I'll stay up while you sleep and vice versa, and I'll make sure that you don't snore.
Make sure I don't snore. Actually, so the one scene I clearly misinterpreted it when they first put it in. I thought they were killing the child. That they had just planned out because they couldn't safely do an abortion or whatever, that she was going to bring it to term and they were going to gas it and then just seal it in a box, because
how would they
keep it around? And so when I first watched it, I was like, I guess they'd have to make that choice. Like, that might be something that they have to do. And so when I saw it, I was like, that would be really tough. Like, how do you make that decision? But then I guess I realized that they had created some kind of soundproof room in order to have their family in. I wasn't sure what they had sorted out there. But at first I thought they were making the decision to kill the child. I thought that's what they were trying to do. And how hard would that be? Because, you know, talking about love, Steve, like what kind of choices would be faced with sometimes in living in that kind of situation?
Well, we asked that same thing, right? What kind of world am I bringing my child into, right?
That's the other thing, yeah. And like, I don't know, maybe it was an accidental pregnancy, like, because I don't know why you'd want to. I mean, she knew at some point she'd have to bear a child silently. I had
that same question.
Oh my God.
Did you guys think about this? I'm like, the ramifications of this moment, you're going to lose your other two kids. You know? Oh my gosh. Yeah.
But going back to that, I was thinking, actually, I was back to the element of love. And I was, again, I was thinking, this is my other thought branching off what Paul was saying about oppression and voice. And I was like, what about not just the power of speaking, but what about the power of listening and listening empathetically? The way I thought about this is that it was like, you could think of it as like judgment versus grace. Right? So the monsters are listeners in judgment. They listen, they hear you, and then they devour you, right? And it doesn't matter what you're saying. Whereas the one character, Regan, she's been trying to listen the entire movie. She's been trying to hear. And when she finally gets the ability to hear, it actually destroys the other creatures, right? And that's the two kind of working against one another. And here's this character who she's seeing, she's sensitive, she feels guilty about what's happened, and she's all these emotions, and she wants to be heard, and she also wants to hear. And I wondered, like, with her having a hearing aid and taking the hearing aid and amplifying that signal, is she amplifying her power of voice, or is she amplifying her power of listening properly? That's actually what's destroying the other creatures. So I was thinking about this too in the film, is that it's like, it's maybe that it's not the power of voice, but the power of empathy that's really the kind of destroying these other beings. Because they're not just devouring mouths, they're devouring ears, right? They actually get these shots on these on their ears, like they're listening to you to destroy you. And as someone who I often find sometimes that even though I'm always trying to express myself well, that I'm not often understood, or I'm afraid of not being understood, it's like being afraid that it's this ear monster that's just going to hear you and mishear you and then devour you, you know, rather than taking the time to actually understand somebody.
Yeah, actually, you make a good point, because Lee Abbott, you know, he wants to bring his son out with him to catch the fish, to bring the fish home, to do all the things that you need to do to survive, because he knows he's got to train his kids in this stuff, because he may not be around. Well, he won't be around forever. And his kid is scared, man. He was terrified, petrified. He didn't want to move. And he knew that the loving thing to do would not be to leave him there in that, but to actually stretch him to grow, to move on beyond that. And so when he's at the waterfall, I mean, he's being heard. He's being, like, he realizes that his father loves him, because there's this moment of empathy. He's still terrified, but when he realizes the waterfall is drowning out their noise from the other ones, he's empowered. And that's this moment of catharsis for that character, because he's like, oh, okay. Like, it's a huge growing moment. He crosses some threshold into a whole new realm of his life and will never be the same again. That's when he finds his bravery and his courage to then lovingly protect his sister, to protect his mother, protect his father. Like, it's dramatically life-changing. And why? Because someone took the time to listen to what his needs were, understand the pain and the fright that he's going through. Yeah. So you're dead on.
I was thinking about that, because I was like, you know, in monsters or creatures, when they're often portrayed, there's always a thing about usually like a mouth or claws. But this is the first time I'd ever seen like a scary ear. And so when I saw that, when they were zooming on another ear, and it's this wide, like the ear itself almost becomes like a gaping maw on the side of its head, right? And it's vibrating and listening to you, and it becomes intimidating. You're like, not only do I feel oppressed in what I want to say, but I'm worried about what I'm saying. And so so that's where I was thinking of the thing, not only just a voice, but also of listening, you know, how the importance of listening in a non-judgmental way. Are the people around me, if I say something and they don't understand me, are they going to eat me? Or, you know, am I going to be consumed or destroyed by them?
And I have no idea, but just because you talk about a scary ear, I started thinking about what other body parts, and I'm thinking like a scary nose, and you could have a smelly place.
Oh my.
Yeah. And like, there's a whole black market trade of just like lavender body wash and stuff. You can't be smelled by anybody.
That's right. Don't make a smell. But, you know, the other thing, though, going back, let's try and cycle it back after that. But one of the things about Love and Lee Abbott is he actually has a very difficult time communicating.
Yes.
When he's in that scene with his son at the waterfall, the son says to him, "Do you blame her for what happened?" Because she blames herself. And he says to his son says to him, "You still love her, right?" And he goes, "Of course I do." He says, "You should tell her."
Yeah.
So there's a stunted communication within the family unit that's causing tension.
And well, then I was just going to say, like, so what Steve was saying, so even if they could speak out loud, without the reservations of being devoured and eaten, would he still have even told her?
Yeah.
Would he be capable of doing so? Does he not have the communication skills, regardless of the situation, right? So that's a good point.
And it could be, you know, right. And they're all a family of grief. I mean, what? It was basically a year and a half. It's only been a year and a half or so since their son died, their brother died, right? And so the kid's brothers died. And I was just thinking about that because when you look at, and this is something I did a little bit of reading on this, but Melisandre said in one of the interviews that they were talking about regarding the sign, because she had a sign communicator with her who could communicate back and forth and could then with the directors and the other actors, because they wouldn't necessarily know how to read sign. But one thing that she noticed is when they were doing their sign language and they were signing in the film, John's character was very staccato. It was very rushed. It was very matter of fact. It was survival mode, John. And that's what his visual communication of how he communicated with sign came across. Whereas Emily Blunt's character, it was much more graceful. It was like, no, you need to be a human here as well, not just survive. We don't want to just have you surviving like in The Walking Dead, you know, or not surviving in that case. But you know what I mean? It's about the whole person. And so I'm just throwing that out there because I think that's a really good point that you make. And his character towards the end is like, maybe it's not so much that he doesn't have the capacity, but maybe it's just the realization that he needs to say it more often, because I think we all have that capacity to love.
Yeah.
It's just, you all have that capacity to communicate it. It's just sometimes realizing that person didn't hear it in the way that they need to hear it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, within the church, and I'm outside the church now too, I guess, but they talk about love languages and you know how you can communicate and hear things in different love languages. So whether it's one person likes to talk, the other person doesn't need to talk, but they just want to sit quietly, or they need gifts or affirmation that way, or touch on the shoulder. You know, how we communicate love can be communicated one way that the other person just doesn't receive it in the same way. And in this way, in this particular film, the other son, which I think is Marcus,
So the one that's alive is Marcus. The one that passed away at the beginning is Bo.
Yeah. But Marcus is almost a translator throughout this entire film, because Marcus is speaking with both of them. And when he's talking with Millicent's character, with Regan, you know, when she's talking about, well, he won't come, he says he will come for you. He accentuates you. I think it's in caps, actually, because of course it's in text on screen. And he's translating for her, not verbally, because they're already doing this, the sign language, but the emotion.
Right.
Which to me, I found just so fascinating. Like you said, Matt, if they could speak, would he have had the words in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I was kind of surprised and not surprised at the same time when, you know, they bring up the fact that he never would have addressed that she might feel guilty as a result of what happened, because she did give her brother the batteries and the rocket ship, and even though she was well-meaning, and that he would never think or consider that she might be holding on to those feelings, or that she might still feel guilty, and that he never talks about it. But at the same time, we're often not encouraged, and I think specifically as dudes, to sometimes talk about those sorts of things, which is really unfortunate. Sometimes, like, you know, guys aren't always encouraged to talk a lot about feelings or a lot about emotions, or to like dig into those emotions or feelings of other people, that we're not always really taught or trained how to be good listeners or be attentive to people's different love languages, as you said. So, you know, that he kind of fell into that trap of kind of being the gristled guy. But at the same time, he's trying to show his love by helping them be prepared for the world that they live in, to make sure they have the tools and skills to take care of themselves. But when you're a kid, it's harder to appreciate that, because the parents are thinking of you when you're 20, but you're like, but I'm a kid now. I just need like a hug and for you to say that you love me and stuff, you know, and that's all she was really looking for. So she's like, stop. And she has the same reaction. She's like, I don't care about the new earpiece that you're putting in my hand right now. I just want to have like my dad, you know, and kind of a normal life and everything else.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is the movie should be titled A Feeling Place.
A feeling place. a place of quiet feelings.
Okay, so here's a thing. The Man in the Woods. I'm going to go there. I think it's interesting because you're talking about, you know, whether you have the capacity to communicate and what that looks like. And we've been talking a lot about language as being a part of that, and the way that you could communicate be through verbal words or even just sounds. And so I would put it out there that that man in the woods, he had a family, but from what we were able to determine, he killed his wife. He left her there. She's dying. And he decides it's like murder suicide at that moment. Right. That family unit of the two of them is in direct polarity with the Abbott family.
Wait, he killed his wife?
I was under the impression that because the creatures had always taken a body, right? They'd always take you. You're gone.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Because it does look like she is injured.
She's all like bloody on her face.
And yeah. Stuff yeah.
Like that, right. So I was under the impression that he killed her and was doing a murder suicide at that moment.
Yep.
Here's a family unit that's really in that way, obviously toxic. And it is the exact opposite of what's going on with that Abbott family.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
They're a unit that is communicating, although not always effectively, but they are communicating. They are demonstrating that love. They are listening to one another.
Yeah.
I mean, what would that relationship been like between that husband and the wife that would actually make him want to kill her? Now, that being said, there's, you know, you're looking at it in the
context. Maybe she snores.
She's like, oh, I gotta end this, right? But you know, like, but you know, just thinking about that in the context of, you know, this man who, you know, is dealing with a social, because they were in the middle of the woods, they were alone by themselves, so there's the social, mental, and physical isolation stress that would have come with that.
Yep.
Right. Yet you have another unit which is kind of all isolated, but they're throwing off the fire signals and lighting those bonfires to be able to communicate with a larger people. So there is some type of societal structure there.
Yeah.
And it's all because they purposely come together to communicate because they're a loving family for the most part. And it kind of, that one moment between the dichotomy between the man in the woods and Lee Abbott really shows the power of voice, because it shows the negative consequences of him being the harbinger of death. He screams, kills himself, and then brings the creature on, you know, the Lee and his son, which then sort of also helps steamrolls. Like they have to hide from him. Whereas when Lee does it, he does it out of a place of genuine pure love to save his kids, to save his family, and it's seen as a noble sacrifice.
Interesting.
That power of voice, but that's so you don't even need to communicate love through sign or through. It's just that demonstration of that love is very interesting.
See, yeah, and the point you brought up too is if they're an antithesis of one another, whereas their family has the, like you said, has the fires lit at the end of the night to communicate with the neighbors, these guys have like a big keep out spray painted on the side of their house, right?
That's
they're isolated themselves.
See, that's interesting. See, that I'm not convinced that he kills her, because the aliens or creatures or
creatures.
Whatever. Oh,
creatures.
Right, fine. The fantastic beasts, if you will. Yeah, they take them, but I don't know if it fits with the film. Like, to me, it makes sense that with his loss, he has nothing left. Because I just got the sense that she had been injured or hurt or killed by the creatures or something had happened. Because correct me if I'm wrong, they were elderly.
They were, yeah.
And you're right.
They were a crypt couple.
What?
You know, like the crypt keeper?
Oh my gosh.
No, come on.
But I just got the sense that her death left him with nothing. Because now he has no one to communicate with. He has no one to help him survive. Because they've isolated themselves. Now, why have they isolated themselves? I don't know.
Right.
But it is definitely a dichotomy. I would just suggest that the dichotomy isn't that the damage was him killing her first. But I want to see it again now, though, because I want to take a look at that.
I never took it your way. Like, we're both seeing it from a different perspective. But you know what that's indicative of? Listening with ears. We're talking and... No, not a joke.
No, not if you're wrong. And no.
Thanks. Whoa. Whoa. You know, maybe I'm wrong. I'm kidding. I'm willing to be wrong on that, but I definitely took this him because Lee puts up his finger and says, "Shh, right, be quiet. Like we're here, and if you're any normal human being, you really wouldn't want to bring death upon other people, even if you're going to commit suicide."
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect to it. See, that's interesting, is because he is so, like, if it was really about him just ending his own life, he'd let them leave.
Yeah.
Like, there seems to be no care for other human life there, because why do it with this guy and his kid there? You can do it at any time. You can wait 10 minutes and fire a gun or scream or do something else. He's almost like a ticking time bomb. It feels like the whole world is a ticking time bomb in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just even there's this beautiful, beautiful moment where the heartbeat, I think it's Emily Blunt's heartbeat. It just tick, 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 and becomes louder and louder.
The child's heartbeat.
Maybe it's the child's. I thought, is that what she's in the bathtub, isn't it?
Because she's listening to her own womb with the stethoscope.
That was it. That's it. It's the stethoscope scene. Yeah. You're right. But the whole world is on this tipping point waiting for collapse. And actually, even visually, I thought it was interesting. They're always walking down the center of the screen. Mm-hmm. Like there's this real sense of balance that they're trying to maintain. You know, just trying to leave no mark and this delicate, well, it's a delicate place and of balance and just.
Is it a Zen place?
it's a quiet Zen, actually. But it just feels like anything that slips out of balance in this particular world is going to send the whole thing into chaos. And actually, this is just a small thing that I noticed, but I feel the need to mention it because it looks like I was paying attention. Did you notice in the empty store shelves at the very beginning that, like, everything is gone except bags of chips?
Oh, I know. I didn't notice that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I was sitting, as I'm watching, I'm like, why is it?
Oh, right.
Literally bags of chips all over the walls and the rest of the shelves are, like, empty.
Yep.
Is really interesting.
Sense. That's a really good point. I did not notice that. Yeah, that was a good eye, good catch. It's funny because I just reached over to grab a tube of Pringles and I started eating them. I muted my microphone. So, like, so I should have thought of that.
That's funny.
Respect.
Here, let me throw something out there.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, so I just became a parent in November, and so I was seeing this film through eyes that I would have never had before, right? Uh-huh. I found it really hurt the heart to watch this at times, but the one thing that I was thinking about is as I went through the experience of becoming a parent, there was a lot of fear and trepidation and sometimes dread associated with that, even in the first few days. I mean, I'm still terrified at times, right? But I can't imagine the sheer terror and guilt that they had at the same time of knowing that they're going to be birthing this joyful baby into the world, yet knowing full well that it could literally kill them. Like it could be the harbinger of death that brings these creatures down upon them. And just the sheer internal struggle that they must have had about that must have been really tough. Yeah, I was just throwing that out there because I know that's something that I kind of felt. And for me, like, you look at any other film involving birth, they tend to be like, okay, we hit this right on the, they kind of do their thing, right? But this one really seemed to hit the nail on the head in terms of that parental expectation and not knowing what's going to happen and creating that terror and that dread. I've never noticed that in another movie. Now, again, I'm biased now, whereas I wasn't before, but I just wanted to throw that there and see what you guys thought.
Well, I first of all, I laugh at you. Because I know how the it changes the way you watch this stuff, man.
I was watching them, and I'm like, they're going to put that baby in that thing. I'm like, they're well-meaning, but that kid's going to die. Like, they're going to wake up and be like, oh, we just screwed this up.
I was like, yo, that's not sanitary. I mean, I need, like, that thing doesn't even have a mobile above the, like, what?
I was like, is that insulation? I'm like, you can't put that near a baby. Like, what are you doing?
You know what they just do to keep it quiet is they give it an iPhone. And, but no, I mean, it totally changes the way that you would view it. And that's why I thought it was funny, because obviously, I mean, I've got two kids, I know. But
I mean, like, in comparison to other films trying to remove that bias, do you think that they're able to do something here that other films haven't been able to do? Because, I mean, you look at Prometheus, right? And Elizabeth Shaw.
Yeah, Prometheus is interesting.
Has this thing inside of her, but it's not the harbinger of a future death that's coming after you. It's the thing inside. It wasn't the same. Right.
Wasn't it the harbinger of a future thing that would kill everybody?
Yeah, I was going to say, it was the harbinger of her own death, actually, in that case.
I didn't find it terrifying at all. I didn't find that moment. I was like, oh, this is kind of lame, right? That's just me and Prometheus now. I might have to go back and listen to the other one, see, maybe I thought it was cool back then.
I'm not a parent, but I supervise a large residence community, and sometimes they're really, really loud and keep everyone up. I don't, like, you know, keep people up from studying, and then I got to get up in the middle of the night and deal with, like, late on-call shifts. And if there was something that would come out of the forest and eat the really loud residents, I'd be okay with that.
In this scenario, Matt sort of takes on the role of the creatures. Actually,
I kind of do, actually, yeah, because I'm the one who gets called when they're really noisy. And depending on how early in the morning it is, and if I've, you know, gone to bed at a decent time, I might be a little bit of a Demogorgon. So, and, you know, I'm sure if people took still photos of me, you could Photoshop them to look like that giant, giant mouth.
Yeah, I just had this image of these kids, like, sneaking into their dorm and having the little painted footsteps on the stairwell.
you knew when you were coming in late night, you knew exactly what spot on the floor to not step.
I know what it is in my own house.
Yeah.
So we've been in our house for about 4 years, and all along the upper level, that floor is noisy, noisy, noisy. And I'm like thinking now as a parent, I'm going to make sure I don't fix that, because now I'll always hear them coming in the house. There is no room to hide in that hallway. Unless you can somehow crawl on walls, it ain't going to happen.
So what you took away from this movie is how to trap your kids. Yeah, so you could just sort of map out what they do and do the opposite in their house.
Exactly.
It's not sand you put down, it's, you know, Lego.
Broken glass.
Oh, man, this took a dark turn real fast. Nails.
Oh, that scene was brutal. I was like, oh, was
so,
my God,
well done.
Nail. Oh.
That was so good. Like, this movie took the smallest things, and, like, as soon as you saw the nail, you knew how that scene was going to play out. But it was still like, no. Thankfully, it wasn't one of those things, too, where it's like, no, don't go in there. It was just like, there's a nail, and she didn't see it. And she was, you know, it was one of those things. I thought it was so, it was great.
It was brilliant. I don't know if you could step on a nail like that and not make a sound, though. I don't know if you could do it. Right into the bottom of your foot?
Didn't
that
she?
Long? No.
She didn't make a sound? I don't remember.
She drops when she's carrying, and that's what makes the noise, I think.
You're right.
She doesn't make a sound.
That's right,
I was like, I don't know if you could do that.
Well, to be fair, this woman knows what she's doing. She also didn't make a sound during childbirth until they set off fireworks, like, midway through the labor, so,
yeah. So you could kind of say that she is tough as nails.
Oh, man.
Oh, snap.
You just had a kid in November, but somehow you're getting good at those dad jokes already. So there you go.
I'm hanging around you too long.
Touche. Well played. I think in all of these things, the reason the film works, the reason I don't want them to make a sequel, the reason I don't want this to be like the Saw franchise, is because the entire film is focused on the family.
Yep. And it had just enough of the turn toward, like, when she cocks the shotgun, you're like, if the movie were to continue another few minutes, it would devolve into an action film.
Yes.
But that's not what it was going to be. So that's where they stopped it. But it had enough of that tone that at the end of it, you're like, yeah, take it, you monsters. We're going to shoot you and kill you. And you finally felt like, ah, because you hated those things so much by the end of the movie.
That's kind of like how I felt. You know, you watch Alien, amazing film, come to Aliens. It's like action flick. What?
That's kind of what. Careful that you don't take on Aliens, all right?
Yeah, that's, just say Aliens was horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like it, but that's, you know, in comparison to Alien, subpar.
Oh, wow.
That's just how I feel that a sequel would be received, at least by this guy.
This worked well because the emphasis was on the relationships. And that was something else, too, that Krasinski emphasized. When he read the script, there were all these flashbacks. When he first read the script, there were all these flashbacks to explain the alien origins, you know, how they got there. You see the little...
Sure.
Yes, fine. The Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. And he said, look, let's cut those out because we need to focus on this moment. And I love that. We don't need to explore the backstory of these creatures because all we need to know is that this family is in trouble. Yeah. That's what this film's about. This film is about this family in trouble, and they're really, it's an impossible situation. And that's why it works.
It's interesting that you say that, because the one of the few breaks that you actually get that sort of pulls you out of the, I've been using the word terror too much, but, you know, the terror of the reality of their lives is when Emily Blunt walks up to John Krasinski and pops in the earbud into his ear, and they dance to Harvest Moon. This is one of those few moments where you get a taste of what a normal life might be like.
Yeah.
Which, from what I understand, is also a bit of a throwback to The Office, because that also happens in The Office, but that's just for those Office nerds.
But I certainly see what you mean. It really feels like a breath.
Yeah.
In the film.
And it needed it.
It did. Yeah. It did.
So, okay, whenever we face an oppressive force, so here's these ear monsters, these creatures that are this oppressive force, whether it's in the States, in Canada, when we have some form of oppression, there's really only two options. One is either to comply or to resist, right? And so it brings about that question or that consideration of what's that responsibility that we have with the voice that we have. I mean, again, they're trying to be as quiet as they can. And I wonder if that really brings into question sort of that responsibility that you have with that freedom of speech or that freedom of expression, that value that we hold so dearly. And we wave that flag, we beat that drum, but how much of what we hear out there is literally just noise that if it was gone tomorrow, it wouldn't matter. But in those moments where it really does, do you resist or do you comply? And I think that brings back that notion of oppression. And like these creatures are oppressing these people, so in this family,
I think yeah, there's a point there, but it's kind of also being able to use your voice strategically.
Yeah.
So if they just went out there, they're going to get picked off one by one, and so that's what he's trying to do, right? He's trying to create the technology, or you know, that eventually it's gonna work. And I think if you're looking at social movements, it's the same way, where people have to figure out how to organize, they got to figure out how to brand themselves, what their vision is, how they're going to communicate that to people, get people on side. So it's not just going out and shouting one at a time, because that's going to get you, you know, eaten. It's about figuring out how to work together and collectively use your voice in a way that's going to be effective.
Well, for me, it made me realize and think about the fact that, like, with my voice, and I don't like the idea of censorship or self-censorship, but, you know, am I being wise with the voice? And I use voice as the capital V, right? Like that essence of who I am, right?
Like the TV show.
Yeah, V, right? But am I using that in an unproductive way, or am I doing something that contributes to a productive, positive society where my voice with a capital B is actually contributing something greater than itself? Because there's a lot of people out there who will just use and fall behind that idea of freedom of expression and freedom of speech. But what they really do is a lot of it can be quite destructive. And that brings up a whole nother question. And so like you had said, they're using their speech and their noise, their sonic impact very strategically. But maybe it just brings up that question of, well, how strategic should we be on a daily basis to make a better world?
More than that, too, if you'll notice, they use their silence. It's a balance between oppression, sure, but they use it for protection.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said, not just for them being strategic of how they speak up, but how they stay silent. Mm-hmm. That almost sounds like I'm going the other way, but I'm not. What I'm saying is that they recognized that there were moments that they needed to sit and quiet, you know, because you're right. The second that they sneeze, they're going to get pegged off one by one. Yeah. So I love the way you're thinking there. I think it's really fascinating way for me to frame the film in my mind, because you're right. Picking and choosing your battles, you know, when John Krasinski gets up and screams, and it's like this, it's not a scream of terror. It's a scream of love. Very much, again, going back to love, it's very much a scream of love, because it's a sacrificial scream. It's a take me, not them sort of scream. My kids will be safe sort of scream by my own loss of life. But it's so intentional. It's not a mistake, because he knows the system. He knows what to do to get around it and get away from these things. And then all of a sudden, bam, here we are, and it's all about his kids. And I think that that's so important. You know, you look at the political landscape and stuff, and I almost think that we've turned protesting into an art form of doing it so often. Now, I think that we need to speak up, and we need to say, no, this isn't right, and we need to say what's right and wrong. But maybe sometimes it's just sort of like spraying it everywhere. I don't know. I think that loses its impact in some ways. That it just becomes, oh, they're speaking up again. You know, another person saying another thing.
Yeah. No, I was thinking more like internet trolls and people like that, and being able to hide behind freedom of speech.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And there's just that kind of noise, right? And you think in terms of advertising noise, I was thinking of in the concept of the noise that we make. Just really, how productive is it?
I'm glad you said that, because you and I were talking about that before. I really like that point. It's a fascinating way to look at the film.
Oh, there was another fascinating way to look at the film, too, that we talked about.
What was it?
Do you remember what that was?
Do you?
Okay. Yeah, this was, I do. I'm actually really excited about this. I think Matthew will find this fascinating. So, because it goes into that notion of empathy. The name A Quiet Place. I understand that this is a space, a sanctuary for these people. They're trying to reduce that sonic impact on their environment to survive.
Yeah.
But at the same time, these creatures are also, in some ways, while they hunt, because that's their primary sense, there's certain sounds that they're saying, no, we need a quiet place from these sounds. And so you could, if you really pushed hard, find a means to sympathize for one component of it. I mean, I hate them. Don't get me wrong. They should all die. But it's just an interesting exercise, a mind exercise to think about. It's like, no, kill those stupid ear creatures, but, you know.
Yeah, the question of it then becomes, what is it that the creatures are looking for? Because you're right, as soon as there's a sound, they have to exterminate it. But, yeah, it's funny, because in some ways these creatures reminded me of the Joker in A Dark Knight. They're just these random forces of nature. There's no story. And I think that's another reason to not include their backstory.
Yeah.
Because if we know that their planet, home planet, has burned to a crisp, or somebody else is oppressing them, or and they've escaped and they're looking for something, then it changes the film entirely.
Right. I also find it really implausible in stories where extraterrestrials that they have faster than light technology, but they don't wear any clothes.
it's an ear with legs. What do you want them to wear?
Well, that's what I mean. So maybe they're not the civilization. Maybe they're a weapon of a civilization. Maybe they're like a genetically engineered xenomorph.
So you just brought the Alien franchise into this universe.
I did little bit, but they, you know, / Demogorgon. Stranger Things. They look like Demogorgons. They do. A Stranger Quiet.
guys, this seems like a good place to start wrapping it up, so let's do Screen It or Skip It. A Quiet Place, Screen It or Skip It?
Screen It.
Screen It, for sure. In theaters, more than once.
I think that would be obvious at this point in the conversation. This is the first film I've seen in 2018 where I feel strongly about recommending.
Yep.
It's not... Go ahead.
I was going to say, like I said earlier, it kind of just renewed my hope and love for independent cinema, so absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, it just works. I mean, you can pick it apart if you want, and get all, you know, nitty, you know, start looking at, like, the logic behind this. It is a fun, well-written, tight thriller. And it's emotional, and it's visual, and it's just an incredible film. I highly recommend it.
I can't wait till Zach grows up a little bit more. Maybe I could show him when he's, like, 3 or 4. What do you think?
and stop it right after the first kid gets taken. That's where you just leave it there.
Like, why has your child never learned to speak yet?
I'm horrible. I'm just joking. I would never do that to you.
Guys, this has been so much fun. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. This has been great. Can you tell us a little bit more? I know you guys are still working on your film. How's it coming along?
It's coming along. So since we spoke last time, we had the privilege of going to Oregon to see the solar eclipse that happened last August and to be part of that wonderful experience. Matthew has always said it's like the cosmos coming and reaching down to you. Whereas we're always trying to go up. And so we did that. That was the last thing we actually shot. And we're in post, which has been a lot of transcripts. A lot of transcripts. And so we're processing through that right now.
Very cool. Very cool.
Actually, I was going to ask Matt, I'm like, since the film that we're working on involves the space shuttle as being a catalyst, how did you feel seeing a toy space shuttle be a catalyst for death?
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a good point, because when that first happened in the movie, I had a completely different feel of what the movie was going to be like. It was going to be this movie of hope and reaching out to the stars as an escape from what's happening on Earth. And then, nope, that kid gets eaten. Like, oh, okay, that's not the direction this movie's taking at all.
That can be your intro. There it is. That's the opening.
The film, so a kid playing with a space shuttle and just getting carried away by something. That's what you get for prodding into the stars.
I just realized, since we're talking about this, some of our audience probably doesn't know about your film. So maybe you could just say a little bit about it.
Do it, Matt.
Okay, yeah, the movie's called Chasing Atlantis. It started as a road trip to go see the final flight of Shuttle Atlantis. And it was inspired by the fact that I always wanted to be an astronaut growing up, but never had that. It just didn't work out that way. And so when the final flight was going, it was kind of this bittersweet moment. And we said, let's go down and go see it. We wanted to bring as many people as possible, and we realized the best way to do that wasn't to bring more cars, but to bring a camera. And so we did, and then when the final flight went up, we got a call back from the Canadian Space Agency asking us if we wanted to do an interview with Chris Hadfield, and it was just on a whim that we had emailed them. We didn't think they would say yes. And then so coming back with the shuttle launch and with that one interview, and knowing that this reached all the way back to our childhoods, we thought, well, maybe there's more story here to tell. We should talk to more people about why they came up to the launch, why people look up at the stars, where our inspiration from space comes from, and realizing that space isn't just a place full of planets and stars and galaxies, but it's full of hopes and dreams, and really asking that question of whether or not we're alone.
Sounds like it's going to be a great project, so I can't wait to hear more about that as it comes.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll keep you posted on its progress.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. For all of you at home, just a reminder that you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and now Spotify, and Stitcher, and Podomatic. If you go to the Screenfish website and go to the podcast page, you can download what we call Fishing for More, which is small group questions that you can have with people that you see the film with, because you're going to go see this film. If you like thrill rides, you're going to go see this film.
Screen it.
Yes, that's a fourth screen it. We've got three people on the podcast, and you just got a fourth screen it. So there you go. It's heavy endorsement. And we will be back next week, since we're a week behind. So we'll be back next week with another independent movie talking about Avengers: Infinity War. And one of those little ones not many people will have seen.
No, no, not at all.
But that'll be our next one. And we also, I'm so proud of our youth. We had a team of teenagers that went through all 18 Marvel movies and podcasted on them. We called it the Infinity Warm-Up, so those are online as well. You can access them. Plus, tons of interviews right now, including Sean Gunn and Terry Notary, who are in Avengers Infinity War. Terry plays Groot, and Sean Gunn plays Rocket. So there's a lot of stuff there. Check it out. It's a lot of great stuff out there right now. But again, guys, Matt, Paul, thank you so much for coming on. This has just been a blast. I could chat with you guys forever.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure.
And for all of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Greenfish.